rain is essential, and so the flowers, the plants, the grass needed to be watered. We thank you, God, for a day where, as a country, we did not experience any major disasters. We thank you, God, for bringing us here safely. And we continue to bless you and give thanks to you as we see the need to be educated, enlightened, inspired. And so tonight, we ask you to be among us and allow us to embrace what is presented so that in our own lives, we can share with others and practice accordingly. These verses we ask in your divine name. Amen. Amen. Can you be seated? Is modern medicine winning the cancer battle, charting a new path forward? Welcome to the Lawyers and Sanford Center. Welcome to tonight's lecture, hosted by Cancer Support Services. I'm Antoine Williams. When we look at the topics, perhaps one can describe them as provocative, because there are many schools of thought as it relates to the distinctiveness of the topics. And I'm sure you who are here will see the need to embrace and perhaps be enlightened and in some way be provoked. I take great pleasure in welcoming all of you. In particular, allow me to welcome the President of Cancer Support Services, Kathy Ann Kelly Springer, the executive members of the council, our speakers, Mr. Ian Lewis and Dr. Elliot Dudley. You who are members of the medical fraternity, you who are here, just like some of us, journeying with cancer, caregivers and supporters of Cancer Support Services, to our sponsors, to all of you, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Breast cancer treatment, slash and burn. Is it time for a new model? Our speaker, who studied for the MBBS in Mola, Jamaica, noted his education at this level was government funded, and he had a strong desire to serve his country in any way he can. He did his internship at the QEH in 1994, and then worked in the Department of Surgery and Orthopedics. He became a fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons of Edinburgh in 2000. He has worked in private practice in general surgery since 2002, and operates at Bayview Hospital. His subspecialty interest is breast cancer, and he has had stints in the general surgery and breast units of Sandwell and Dudley Hospital, West Midlands, at the Royal Bournemouth Hospital in the UK. You, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure can agree with me that our speaker is well qualified to address the topic, breast cancer treatment, slash and burn. Is it time for a new model? Kindly acknowledge Mr. Ian Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your kind words. Thank you to the Cancer Support Services for inviting me to give this lecture. You know, on the way in, I stopped at the gas station, and the guy who was pumping the gas, he looked at me and said, "Doc, how are you today?" I said, "I'm fine." "If I'm better than fine, I'm great." I said, "You're great." I said, "I love the rain." Who knows me knows that I love the rain. But his take on this was this, "I hate the rain." And I said, "Why?" He said, "I'm getting wet, and I'm underpaid." But you know, a lot of what I'm going to say today is basically that, a balance of, you have to accept mercies and accept that in most things in life, there are benefits and there are risks. And the rain provides nourishment, it replenishes the wells, it cools us down. You know, rain is good. If it causes flooding, if it causes mudslides and so on, those are little things if you ask me. So let's go forward with our talk. The topic is really about breast cancer, but I'm going to generalize it to talk about cancer in general. What is cancer? Cancer represents uncontrolled cell growth that eventually wants to spread to the rest of the body, what we call metastases. It is recognized that cancer is actually probably not just a single disease. Any one person having a cancer probably has a series of diseases that results in a group of renegade cells dividing at alarming rates and not respecting the tissues and the laws of the body. What is the scope of the problem? I'm not sure if you can see this, you probably can't. It's very hard to see from there. This is better compliments of Dr. Shinoy and his hardworking team at the Department of Oncology at PU. And this was all the cancer referrals they got in that department in 2011. And basically, Dr. Shinoy has tabulated that. He has tabulated that in 2011, out of 440 cancers, 116 were due to female breast cancer. And in that year as well, out of 60 colon cancers, they were equally divided between male and female. And interestingly, what I found interesting was that prostate cancers referred to that department numbered only 64. And that essentially tells us that although they're doing good work in collecting data, it is not comprehensive, or the system of collection is not comprehensive, because there are lots more than 64 types of cancers in Barbados.
And certainly
it speaks most likely to the fact that a lot of patients are getting care exclusively in the private sector. But that just speaks to the complexity of collecting data in a small island state. So cancer, as we said, results from bad cells. They disobey the rules of the body, and these rules generally tell the cancer cells, or tell normal cells, rather, how and why and when to divide. And cancer cells are considered immortal colonies of cells that circumvent a process called apoptosis, or programmed cell death. Cells are born and they're supposed to provide a function, and then cells are supposed to die off to allow new cells to come in and take over. That's apoptosis, but cancer cells circumvent apoptosis. And the interesting and clever thing about cancer is that as the cells grow, they literally create conditions that favor more growth. And one of these conditions that occurs is the creation of new blood cells, or angiogenesis, to fuel even more growth. So you get a circular action. And certainly angiogenesis is now seen as a potential target for cancer treatment. The Edwin Smith papyrus, which dated from 1600 before Christ, documents breast cancer as the first cancer written about. But cancer was known about for much longer than that, much longer than 1600 BC. In fact, the Greek word is carcinos, was used in the early medieval times to describe the disease. Carcinoma, or carcinoma, is where we get that term from. Cancer is the Latinized form of carcinos. And cancer, literally in Latin, means crab. You know the constellation Cancer, you know the Aries and Libra. Cancer is always a crab. And you can imagine the early scholars on seeing the body of cancer within tissues and seeing the shape of cancer, they likened it to a crab. So we can see that this is a very appropriate description of cancer. For a long time, cancer was thought of to be caused by blockages and clutterings within the body. And this combined more or less a structural and a functional theory of the causation of cancer. And hence this led to bloodletting and the use of purgatives back in the day. But we know that in 1775, a young British surgeon by the name of Percival Cox, he made the observation of chimney sweep carcinoma. And around that same time, others had noticed the association between smoking snuff or sniffing snuff and the development of cancer of the nose. And this ushered a paradigm shift in the thinking as to the causation of cancer. This was the environmental theory. These little boys, the chimney sweeps, sometimes no older than 4 years old, they were employed to shimmy up these chimneys to get the soup down. But during their work, they would sweat. They were normally bareback, and the sweat would bring mounds and mounds of charcoal down their bodies to lodge where the underwear was in the scrotal area. And Dr. Fox pretty much figured out that the charcoal was causing cancer of the scrotum. The environmental theory was born, as I said just now. With the development of safe anesthesia in the 1800s and antiseptics, and systemic anatomic and physiological inquiry of the body, surgery was taken from the ambit of the street practitioner and became an established part of medical mainstream. Back in the day, surgery was actually performed by not doctors, but by skilled persons with scissors and knives, literally by barbers. So that man who cut your hair and trimmed your mustache was the same man who was expected to remove the ruptured appendix. And you can imagine the surgeons were not lettered people. They were not respected. They were not university trained. In contradistinction to the physicians who were always lettered and who were always university trained and who were always well respected. Times have changed. Full circle. 1870 to 1970 became known as the century of the surgeon across the USA and Europe. And the treatment, the surgical treatment of cancer, was at the vanguard of surgical treatments in general. Sir Dr. William Halstead, probably the greatest American surgeon who lived, lent his name to many procedures and many instruments are still used in the operating room today. Like all great men, he had a vice. Dr. Halstead was actually addicted to morphine for most of his career, and this was only found out towards the end of his career. And this is actually the hospital that he co-founded with three colleagues, John Hopkins Hospital. And today it is seen as probably still the best hospital in the world. I mention Sir Halstead because he had developed the radical mastectomy, a very formidable operation for curing breast cancer in the day. It removed much more than the breast. The operation was performed in America and Europe from the late 1800s to the mid-1900s. But there was a dramatic fall off in the use of this operation in the mid-1900s due to many reasons, due to better tumor control by other means, scientific inquiry and papers that basically reveal that doing less was just as good as doing a lot. And believe it or not, the emergence of who? The emergence of the female surgeon. Imagine that. The ones with the softer touch indeed. The Halstead model of cancer progression suggested that cancer grew from a center, from an epicenter, and presumed that this growth was orderly and, as we would say, contiguous out. Literally, cancer started in the center, and the path of cancer spread was predictable in terms of the radius of the distance away from the center. So he surmised that by doing radical surgery, once one stayed ahead of the tumor bulk, then there was a good chance of getting, as the Belgians would say, the doctor epithet. That was Dr. Halstead's way, literally keeping ahead of the mass or the bulk of the disease. It took us about 50 years to realize that this mutilation was not bringing the anticipated results. The systemic theory of spread, which is the other theory now, so we have the Halsteadian theory of spread, cancer, orderly, contiguous out. The systemic theory of spread suggested that the potential of spread was indeed there, or is there, even when the tumor is at a small size. I'm going to repeat that, because this theory is what we hold true to be a fact today. The systemic theory of cancer spread suggests that even at small sizes, cancer can be metastatic. What cancer likes to do, as I said before, imagine these were a clump of cancer cells. What they like to do is to create a situation where new blood vessels literally adhere to them, and they hitchhike into these blood vessels as a means to travel around the body. At specific sites, these cancer cells are going to egress or exit from the bloodstream and plant roots into tissues and create metastases. So the systemic theory is suggesting that this happens at an early stage of cancer. So chemotherapy really was initially used to manage the blood cancers, the leukemias and the lymphomas. And it did so with very good effect. But chemotherapy, back in the 60s, was now transferred to the solid organ cancers. The breast cancers, prostates, colons, lung cancers, and so on. Because of the new systemic theory. It was now all about addressing the micro disease in the bloodstream, in addition to dealing with the primary that the surgeons were dealing with. Hence, the 1960s, ushered the beginning of combination therapies to effect both local and systemic control. That was the beginning of surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy in combination, or as the topic today says, slash, poison, and burn. Effective treatment strategies can only become reality if we fully understand the natural history of the process we're trying to treat. So the question scientists have been trying to answer, the quest to develop better and more effective strategies, the questions have been, what causes cancer? Is it purely a genetic mishap? Is it metabolic? How does the environment tie in? Can we prevent cancer? These questions still have question marks. But here are some facts on what we think about the causation of cancer. And by and large, genes in the center of cells are the seat for the determination of cancer. I'm going to repeat that. Genes in the center of cells are the seat for determination of cancer. I am basically saying that all cancer has a genetic basis. There's a difference between hereditary basis and genetic basis. Hereditary suggests cancers that will traverse generations because of specific genes. A genetic basis is suggesting that that could be intergenerational or intragenerational. It's just that it's related, the mechanism is related to the center of the cell. So all cancer is center cell related. Genes are spelled with a G and not with a J. We still see that from time to time. Genes are the chemicals that program the cells. They're the master drivers of the cells. The important instructions, as far as cancer is concerned, the important instructions that genes give would be how to multiply and when to die. Bad genes can corrupt these instructions. Bad genes can lead to cells that just want to divide all the time, and cells that resist death or resist apoptosis, as I said before. 95% of cancers are due to genetic mutations influenced by external factors. 95% of cancers are environmentally driven. We can list tobacco, alcohol, red meat, obesity, radiation, human papillomavirus, virus, hepatitis virus, radiation. These are all external factors that can ultimately lead to damaged genes and corrupt codes. There will be 30% less cancer deaths in the world if people didn't flood their lungs with nicotine and smoke. Tobacco smoke contains how many carcinogens? Not 5, not 15, 50 carcinogens. Obesity is a factor in 14 to 20% of cancer death in America. Obesity and inactivity contribute to 30% of breast cancer recurrences in the postmenopausal age group. 18% of cancer is infectious, whether it's viral, bacterial, parasitic, and we can talk Epstein-Barr virus, H. pylori, and there's even a little worm called a schistosoma that occurs in fresh water that can do it in the bladder. What about radiation? Radiation is all around us. It directly damages the DNA that contains the genes. There's ultraviolet radiation in sunlight. There's radiation in concrete. And it is said that if you take a plane, travel from Barbados to London, you've just taken a chest X-ray. Literally, radiation is all around us. We can't get away from it. Another statistic. Only 5% of cancers are truly inherited through family genes. So remember we said 95% are environmentally determined. 5% are truly hereditary. So that lady coming to me and said, "Doc, I'm surprised I have breast cancer because it doesn't run in the family." Fits exactly into this. Examples of genes that run through family lines will be the BRCA1 and 2 that code for breast and ovarian cancer. And there are certain colon cancer genes that can pass through families as well. And the thing with these hereditary cancers, they tend to manifest at an early age. So overall, the best way to tie this all together in terms of the influences that determine cancer causation is to say that cancer is a complex interplay of bad genes, bad habits, and the environment. And some people would put in their bad luck as well. So another question that we are trying to answer as scientists would be, yes, we know bad genes are the culprit, But what turns them on? What is that chemical or biochemical reaction that turns on the bad genes? You know, we're still trying to answer it. There's a branch of study called metabolomics. There are proteomics, the study of pathways and the study of proteins. And scientists think they're getting closer and closer to answering what causes that switch on pathway. You're all going to laugh now. You're going to get into familiar territory. The question is sugar, the sugar pathway, linked to cancer? Simply the commonest question that I deal with in practice. Can I cut out sugar and do well from this cancer? Can I prevent myself from catching cancer by cutting sugar down? I would hasten to say that a number of patients have succumbed to bad outcomes in their quest to deprive their cancer of sugar. They became catabolic, they lost weight in a state that's already catabolic, and they couldn't afford to lose any weight. You see, you need energy to fight a process that is formidable. The idea that cancer feeds on and is dependent on sugar stems from a 1924 paper written by Dr. Warburg on metabolism of tumors. That's the title of it. He suggested that cancer cells grew and prospered when sugar was available in the absence of oxygen. Dr. Dublin and myself were just discussing this. In essence, he was pointing to mitochondrial dysfunction. The mitochondria are little organelles within the cell where energy is created. And Dr. Warburg suggested that cancer was basically a side effect of bad energy production. The jury is still out. Is cancer directly linked to sugar? But here are some very interesting relations. Type 2 diabetics are more prone to certain cancers. Cancer of the liver, cancer of the pancreas, uterus, colon, breast, bladder. There are other relations as well. The older we get, the more we are likely to catch both diabetes and cancer. Men are more likely to be diabetic, and men are more likely to catch cancer overall. Black Americans and whites both have high cancer rates. Black Americans, Afro-Caribbean persons, Hispanics, have very high diabetes rates. Diabetics are prone to being overweight, and overweight persons tend to be inactive. And there's a study that shows that overweight persons tend to indulge in smoking. Drinking more than one unit per day for a woman, and more than two drinks a day for a man, increases the risk of both cancer and diabetes. Yes. Seemingly some kind of link there between a high sugar state and cancer. Research at Duke University has shown that cancer makes use of sugar and proteins to resist apoptosis. And what about the PET scan? Everybody knows about the PET scan now. FDG, which is the chemical administered to do a PET scan, is a cousin of sugar. And it is radiotype, and it is taken up by cells with a high metabolic rate. Those will be liver cells, brain cells, and cancer cells. So you have a sugar-like molecule that targets cancer. It produces an intense radiolabeling of these areas and is used for the detection of metastases. Another important point is obesity, because obesity is linked to diabetes. Obesity and high insulin levels are shown to be linked to cancer. The obese postmenopausal woman, as I said before, has a higher risk of recurrence of her breast cancer compared to her lean counterpart. The recurrences in this group can be lessened by 30% by weight reduction alone. So the adage is, be lean without being underweight if you're serious, or if you're going to be serious about cancer prevention. So all of us sweet tooth persons, avoid empty sugars, that is sugar, elemental sugar without nutrients. It has energy, but it has no nutrients. It is okay to use natural sugars once it is occurring within what we call a nutrient-dense diet. For political reasons, that's all I'm going to say about sugar and cancer. It's a work in progress. I don't know where on the fence I am. Maybe Dr. Dugman, when he comes, can tell us from his point of view where he stands in that argument. But let us talk about cancer eradication on the current model, the model of the systemic theory. So why do we do? Why do we as conventional practitioners do what we do? And I want to use a simple example to drive home certain points. Let us say the body is the soil or the land, and the cancer cells are what? They're the weeds. If we don't get rid of the weeds early, then they will flourish and they will take over. So it's better to work with the weeds when few are around. The current conventional model of cancer eradication devotes itself almost exclusively to handling the weed itself, and it doesn't address the body or the soil from which the cancer grows. The body is made up of 200 types of cells, numbering about 40 million, million, million. There are white cells, red cells, osteocytes, myocytes, neurons, you can name it. 40 trillion cells, all working in unison. The plantation of soil, the body, is comprised of systems of organs that communicate via chemical messengers in the bloodstream. These are proteins and hormones. This cooperation within the plantation that goes on for decades, and if you look at it, it goes on for 7 decades, if you're lucky. This is absolutely spellbinding. And whether you believe in creation, whether you believe in evolution, the existence of a well-lubricated human being for 7 decades equals in wonderment the origin of the man and woman. But what's wrong with focusing on the weed alone as we do now? It means we fail holistically to deal with the problem. Our preventive plan becomes leaky. The farmer may pluck hard, but unless certain things are put in place, the weeds will do what? They'll come back. And he will have a lot more plucking to do in the future. He could ensure eradication by burning the roots, as is still done by some farmers. That's irradiation. Or he can use Ramoxone or Roundup. I hope he doesn't cause any, not too much damage the rest of the flock. But one sensible farming strategy is to address the soil, to allow good crops to grow, and to allow these good crops to crowd out the weeds. Beef up the soil. Going forward, medically, this will be just as important as addressing the cancer itself. For example, by boosting the body's policeman, which is the immune system. Improve the body's defenses and provide the body with all the micronutrients that it needs to fight. So let us break down the current policy of slash, poison, and burn. In turn, surgery, which is a slash. Surgery is the shortest and fastest way to eradicate solid tumors. But as we saw before, in the systemic theory of early spread, surgery alone is hardly ever going to be enough. Because from early, cancer is vascular, and there is simply no surgical procedure for purifying the bloodstream. Radiation. X-rays and radiation were discovered in the 1800s, and they rapidly gained favor to treat infections and to treat tumors, but lots of people died from radiation exposure. Radiation is an invisible energy beam that is added to surgery to improve the local control, the primary area. A meta-analysis in 2004, looking at a number of studies for breast cancer, showed that radiation prevented local recurrences in 80% of those studies. In breast cancer management, if you opt to keep the breast, you almost always will be recommended to do radiation treatments. Radiation, frankly, just works. And this shows you how external radiation is given. This is the mini accelerator machine. SpaceAge is a highly computerized way of delivering radiation. So radiation has really come from being given in crude and safe machines to being highly focused systems for which patient safety can be vouched. Chemotherapy. But animal studies have shown a burst in activity at metastatic sites after surgery is done on the primary. Lady has a breast cancer, she has it operated on. If she has spread to her lung, when that breast is operated on, that area in the lung can clear up. This is likely due to surgery itself suppressing immunity, surgery resulting in the loss of inhibitory factors that kept the metastasis in check, or stimulation of new blood vessels. In addition, or additionally, as we saw earlier, cancer is a systemic process from early, characterized by micrometastases. So local treatment should be supplemented with systemic treatment. That is where chemotherapy comes in. This use of intravenous cancer-killing medicines stepped off from its initial use for leukemia and lymphomas back in the 1960s. I want to say a little bit on screening. Although screening is not treatment, it is bound to treatment, and screening is very, very controversial. Some people think that screening is a treatment tool. I didn't believe this, but after examining this for years, I agree. Some people misuse screening as therapy. I just had my mammogram, or I just had my pap smear, and I'm good for another year or two. And what they're saying is that not that the result was good, they're saying the process of doing it has them covered going forward for a year or two. For me, it makes perfect sense to subject an apparently healthy population to a test that's going to flush out early disease once the test is cheap, it is available, and it is repeatable. It is cheap, available, and repeatable, and these are the essential points of a good screening test. Whether it's the mammogram, whether it's the PSA, whether it's the pap smear, it must be cheap, it must be available, and it must be repeatable. If, you know, one test gets messed up, you need to do it over again. Screening policies must suit the demographics of the location. For example, in Japan, with their high consumption of dried, salted meats, stomach cancer, true gastric cancer, is a public health issue. It's very, very common. So stomach cancer screening is offered in Japan, not in Barbados. Melanoma skin cancer is a major, major issue in Australia. So they screen for it on a regular basis. In the Caribbean, breast cancer, prostate cancer, they're the common screenings. One of the most baffling and angering things about breast cancer management has been confusion among patients and doctors as it relates to mammograms. Are they useful? Are they harmful? What is the best schedule? When do I start? Unfortunately, you'll get a different answer depending on who you talk to. The United States Preventive Services Task Force is a powerful body that advises on screening tools in America. It is staffed by physicians and epidemiologists. And their aim is just to set screening based on results. They're not going to look at anything but results. They're going to be evidence-based. And here are some of the recommendations that they have made in recent years. Aspirin use in men and women to combat cardiovascular disease. Colonoscopy at 50. CT scans in persons at high risk for lung disease, that's just smokers and so on. People working in dusty areas with exposure to allergens and so on. Interestingly, in 2012, the task force recommended against the use of PSAs. They said, stop doing PSAs altogether. The results we're seeing do not justify the continued use of PSAs. They have come out against the use of mammograms, but as of 2009, the recommendation by the task force is that women between the age of 50 to 74 should do mammograms every 2 years. There's no recommendation for this to be done above 75, and the reason is that age group has not been studied. What if you're under the age of 50? The instruction there is to talk to your patient, assess risk as a doctor, assess their individual risk, because the data does not support that doing mammograms has decreased mortality in this age group. So talk to your patients between 40 to 49. Certainly between 50 to 74, you can do your mammograms every 2 years. The American Radiology Society says do mammograms every year from the age of 40 and don't ever stop. Once you have breasts, you don't ever stop. Most breast specialists have adopted the scheduling of those two bodies, either the American Radiology College or the task force. But evidence basis is the crux of the matter. I want to, in the interest of time, I'm going to leave that alone and press on with another part of the treatment of cancer, which is basically use of drugs. I thought people hated taxes. I thought you guys hated politics. I thought you hated the current West Indies for the team. You know what you guys hate? You hate popping pills. I am not sure why. I guess the presumption is that anything made in a laboratory is harmful. And yet, anything that comes from a natural source is without side effects. As doctors, we know this is a grave estimation. As a young intern, just graduated, probably my second rotation at the hospital, I saw a woman die from drinking too much water. What can be more pure and benign than water? This lady was a lady with heart failure who was on restriction of fluid. Her husband smuggled a bottle of water in against medical advice. I personally saw her drink the water and she was dead a few hours later. So benign water can kill. So don't make the mistake of thinking that natural products do not have such effects. In one 7 millimeter by 7 millimeter tablet, you get a concentration of good top scientific brains who were working at it for years. So let me try somehow to debunk the mystery of pills and your fear of pills. Over 10% of all drugs, or only 10% of all drugs, started in human trials become approved drugs. Only 10%. A new cancer drug has to be discovered, it has to be purified, it has to be tested in the lab before entering a clinical trial. Generally, the lab work lasts for 6 to 10 years. It then enters 4 phases of clinical trial, which can last from 8 to 10 years. So overall, it takes from conception to clinical use, a drug can take 20 years to get to the public. Drug companies apply for a patent for a new drug. And normally this protects them for 20 years. They have exclusive rights to that drug. And this is a clear thing. The patent protection enables the owner to recoup costs of research and development through profit margins for the branded product. When the patent protection expires, a generic drug is usually developed by a competitor. So that's how we get generic. Drugs come off patent, and then that chemical is copied by other companies. And these tend to be far less expensive. So all breast cancer ladies, lots of you use tamoxifen, branded as Novodex, but then when it came off patent, the tamoxifen was copied by other companies as well. Tamoxifen is interesting, actually, when you don't like taking tamoxifen. It was discovered in 1967. And it is on the list of the WHO most essential drugs list. Means it's a drug the world cannot do without. Some patients read the side effect profile and decide they're never ever going to take it. But like I said before, everything has a side effect. Walking next to a bus has a side effect. Including the ultimate side effect. What's that? Death. The wheel can break off and the bus can hit you on. But does it happen? It can happen, but does it happen? So you need to keep things in context. So drug development is costly. And drugs that fail, they don't make it through. Drugs that fail incur large costs without revenue. The cost of developing a new drug, excluding the market prices, is $1.3 billion. One drug. Industry-wide research and investment in the pharmaceutical industry was $65 billion in 2009. There has been some controversy in the industry. There's been allegations of hiding or faking results, lobbying, bribery. And frankly, it is one of the largest industries in the world. And because of these above, patients are suspicious of medicines and doctors who write medicines. So they link us, the doctors, to big pharma. There is no one sitting behind a desk to pay me or to pay any other doctor for prescribing drugs. I drive a 10-year-old Nissan and I'm very, very comfortable doing it. So we as medical or conventional practitioners, we have to admit certain things. And we know certain things. Drugs also come direct from natural sources. And there are many examples. There's digoxin from foxglove, there's recipine from the Ruwalfia, there's colchicine from the crocus, the autumn crocus, and morphine from the opium poppy. Vincristine is a powerful, powerful chemotherapy drug. It comes from the periwinkle, the Madagascar periwinkle. I was trying to research to see if we do have periwinkle in Barbados, but I'm not sure if we have the Madagascar periwinkle. But the vincristine is such a powerful drug that it alone has been responsible for the elevation of survival rates from leukemias, childhood leukemias, from less than 10% to over 90%. There are about 500,000 plant species on the earth. 5,000 have been extensively studied for medicinal purposes. 121 prescription drugs come from plants. 74% of these were discovered following up on folklore things. Noni, soursop, moringa, turmeric, the list is there. So we, the conventional practitioners, must yield to persons with knowledge of the herbs, but the challenge must be laid down for the development of an effective pharmacopoeia of these natural medicines, standardizing formulation and doses and side effects. It's common for that lady to come to me to ask me how many soursop leaves to use, how often do I use it, what are the side effects? I don't know. I should know, I would love to know. Information is just not there. Another reason why patients get suspicious of conventional medicine is due to the anxieties created by inefficient and painful diagnostic processes. Less than perfect screening tests leads to and will always lead to unnecessary biopsies. We actually have to look at cancer itself and the definition of cancer, I think. We have to look at it to see if we can solve this problem. Pathologists will tell you that once you look down the microscope and you see large, heavily staining nuclei in irregular-looking cells and variations in sizes of the nuclei, you're looking at cancer. You're labeled cancer. And just to use that word triggers, you know what? Triggers your entry into the system of slash, poison, and burn. This definition is purely anatomic. This has been the model for 100 years. It says nothing about the behavior of the cells that we're seeing. There are some cancers, there are some thyroid cancers that will never threaten a patient's life. Basal cell skin cancers, despite how big and ugly they look, they will never spread. They will never threaten a patient. DCIS, ductal cancer in situ of the breast, most of them, if left alone, will never cause problems. And this has been proven in autopsy studies. Yet, a precise triple-negative breast cancer is always a threat to life if it remains in the patient's body. So what we're saying is that molecular profiling of cancers is just as important as the anatomic profiling for cancer. And you know, the world is going towards that. When you go to modern conferences, the molecular aspect of cancer, the science of cancer, is achieving more and more importance. And this is what the large countries have on us, the ability to type behavior and the surface molecules of cancer cells. So I have basically just gone through what I thought can help in this whole, help you to understand why slash poison and burn has been there for 100 years and why it probably will be there for a little bit longer. But what does Dr. Lewis say about cancer prevention going forward? And there are certain things here that we know already. I will add in that I think going forward a redefinition of cancer needs to take place. Certain things that we know are that will not behave malignant, don't label it cancer. Don't put that patient in the system. We know about weight management. We talked just now about the rational use of sugar. Maybe it is related to cancer causation. Maybe it's not. We just don't know. Knowledge of your family history And especially for men, do not ignore symptoms. I think the time has come to give mammography a new name. It's been mired in so much controversy that even saying the word turns people off. Adopt screening programs that suit us locally and regionally. Can we do like Britain and have a subsidized national mammogram program or national PSA program, school testing program? Why don't we offer incentives for people to visit doctors when they're well? And that's at the level of the insurance companies, industrial companies, and even probably at the governmental level. We have to look towards improving the soil of the body by immune strengthening therapies. That's the use of vaccines, stress management. Stress is a bad thing, you know, it can damage the immune system. And we have to look at our diets as well. And cancer education needs to start much earlier than we're doing it now. This is important. As a society, demand more from your GPs. Hasty exams allow persons to slip through. A person, you know, psychology is a strange thing. A person who survived a hasty exam and purposefully kept that breast mask from the doctor, you leave that office and rationalize that if the doctor didn't see it, it is not important. It happens. So if you realize your GP is not making you undress at least once a year, something is wrong. A comprehensive integration of conventional and complementary practices is a must. Complementary practices and data should include randomized controlled trials and peer-reviewed data. It's all for the sake of the patient. The Cancer Treatment Center of America is doing great work in this respect. The best way to treat this cancer is to avoid getting it. We can't control bad genes, but we can certainly control bad habits, and to a lesser extent, or greater extent, bad environments. So that is the bulk of my talk today. I'm just going to finish by just going through quickly for you a couple typical questions that I am asked on a regular basis, and basically to give you the responses that I have learned to give over almost 20 years of breast cancer management. And hopefully these are some of the questions you would have asked me, so in the interest of time, maybe you can flow smoothly into Dr. Douglas' presentation. So this is the patient. Will it ever get cured of this cancer? This is Dr. Lewis. Don't do that to yourself. Cancer genes are likely still in your body despite your treatment. There's always a risk of recurrence. It is better to talk remission and control rather than cure. That doesn't mean you shut up shop and you wait for the recurrence. You live your life and you don't look back. Look at diabetes and high blood pressure. More people actually die from diabetes and high blood pressure than cancer, but you don't talk cure for hypertension or for diabetes. Control your soil, control your body and live your life. Why can't you talk to my osteopath? That's another question. I would say I can, but I can only relay what information I have and what plans I have in terms of conventional treatments. I can't give an opinion on alternative practices as I have not been a student of these. You know, a study of a large pool of Canadian women with breast cancer showed that 66% of these patients discontinue conventional methods in favor of alternatives. The same likely obtains in Barbados. The pull of natural methods and the push of conventional can be strong. You will have to make up your own mind as you go. A friend of mine does not agree with how you are managing me. And this is what I would say. I trained for many years. I attend international conferences with top experts. I've been practicing for almost 20 years and I am still learning. Your friend is a sun breast cancer expert. To be able to read the internet for a few nights and then to know what is best for you. Will I get better care overseas? Response: the grass is taller, but not necessarily greener. We get a lot of practice in this small country treating cancer. Our experts are well trained. Despite our best efforts, we will lose some clients. But this happens overseas as well. The richest people overseas are the actors and the entertainers. And they die from cancer as well, and they have everything available to them. Should I switch surgeons or oncologists? Mary had surgery with that surgeon and she died. We will lose patients from time to time. In essence, why blame the doctor rather than the cancer? It speaks to the resilience of the cancer rather than poor care by your professional. That is what cancer is good at, trying to find a way back. Spend your energies fighting the cancer and not the doctor. He did not give it to you. I want to starve this cancer of sugar. Should I do it? You will starve yourself first. How can malnourishment allow you to fight this process? Be sensible in avoiding sugar, but you can't avoid it in totality. And the last one, can I do surgery and skip the chemotherapy? The indication for chemo is rigidly made. We know it is not easy to do chemo. Surgery is for local control, but will do nothing for bloodstream control. In fact, surgery can worsen the cancer in the bloodstream. It comes down to risk versus benefits, but you run the risk of a bad outcome with no treatment or harsh treatment. So that, in a nutshell, is my lecture to you this evening. I want to say thank you, and I think I will open the floor to just a few questions. Any questions or comments?
Good evening, sir. Thank you so much for all the light you shed. Name is Everton Holligan. I'm an aspiring politician, but I'm probably not going to be very political. As you mentioned earlier, something to do with sugar, but then you pause for a bit. And I wanted a little bit more from that, and it had me trying to come up here to get that rest out of you. There are a few comments you have made that somehow these bad genes are turned on, and we don't know why or how. There's a lot of controversy around the world about vaccinations right now. Could it possibly be linked to vaccines and the ingredients of vaccines? That's one. The other thing was, what I think would be so amazing is if we had forums for natural practitioners and doctors to come together to flesh out some of these issues so the public can benefit from it. I'm not sure who would be the body to coordinate those types of forums, but I imagine it could be quite useful, since you did say there are things within that field that certainly you're not aware of, and there are things within the natural field that they wouldn't be aware of that are so important to know. And there's always been an attack on red meat. Why is the white meat getting off the hook? Because it's white? I mean, the chickens aren't using anything natural. Could it possibly be that the white meat and chicken and turkey could also be implicated in creating problems for the body. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's start with the query as to the fora for the connection of the alternatives and the conventionals. You know, I don't think that's going to happen in my lifetime. It is a political issue more than anything else. And I did have a lot more to say in the body of my talk. I opted not to go into it. Essentially, you're talking about two professions that are not happy people to be. In terms of regulation, in terms of oversight, the playing field is not level. And if the playing field is not level, the respect is not going to be there. I think the challenge is literally for the alternative practitioners to organize themselves. It's not on the conventional practitioners. The challenge is for the alternative or the complementary practitioners to organize themselves into a professional body with oversight and with openness. Just like a patient knows that I am registered to practice in Barbados, I can't do foolishness or else I'll be disciplined, the same thing needs to happen for the alternative practitioner. And that in no way speaks to my criticizing them as a group. As I said, we need to work together and we have to work together to effect better outcomes. Dr. Duggan is better at answering about sugar and white meat, but I am pretty certain the myoglobin content in meat is what determines whether it is white or red. And the higher the myoglobin content, the greater the carcinogenesis, the more the likelihood of cancer transformation in the gut system. And so it's not that white meat is without risk, it's just that the risk is higher, the higher the content of myoglobin. The whole idea of sugar and cancer, I don't want to say much about it because it's a, like I said, it's a work in progress as far as my study is concerned. I admit that, you know, there are too many pointers to suggest that a link is not there. So a link is there, the exact biochemical link I am not sure of at this point in time. And the advice to patients is, you make sure elemental empty sugars are not in the diet. But if your sugar is going to be part of a wholesome diet, it should be okay.
Yeah, Dr. Lewis, let me thank you for the presentation. I was listening to everything you said, there was some political connection, but it's a suspect that there are some chances politically that we can get rid of. But you mentioned during the presentation that cancer does not like oxygen. In the blood. I have heard no mention of how you can get oxygen into the system to deal with cancer that it don't like. And if we are to look at alternatives, there's many studies across the world, modern studies, that are focusing on alternatives in trying to get oxygen into the system, which creates a problem for the cancer cells because they do not exist in oxygen. I'm not sure if it cures it or what, but I certainly would like to hear if we are interested in looking at alternatives. If we keep doing the same thing over and over, and where is the challenge to look at some of these modern things like ozone and things like that? There's one.
Yeah, the link between oxygen and cancer death is certainly being talked about for decades now. And just as topical as sugar and cancer is now, oxygen and cancer is as well. As far as I'm aware, there are two ways of delivering oxygen, or there are two types of oxygen you can use to flood the system, as it were. There's hyperbaric oxygen, which is normal oxygen, but under higher pressure forced into the body, generally through the lungs. And there's ozone therapy, which is ozone is a supercharged form of oxygen. The other name is trioxygen, three oxygen atoms rather than two. I am not going to say anything about ozone or hyperbaric because I do not know. Dr. Dublin, we were discussing it, and we know that certain people swear by it. but I don't know what the pros and the cons are. But ozone in itself is a powerful antimicrobial, and it is powerful at cleaning structures. So technically, if a body can tolerate ozone, you should get good effects from that. But we'll wait and hear what Dr. Douglas says about his knowledge of oxygen therapy. Certainly the theory there of oxygen being toxic to cancer, that's accepted now by many, many scientists. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I thank you for your indulgence. We await Dr. Douglas.